basically, the older man admitted. But be honest, Captain. We both know there are psychopaths in any organization. Modern mental health and nanite chemical rebalancing do wonderful things. We just found them in the ranks of the Space Force's pilots and nurtured them. Intel's Black Ops forces are shadowy and vicious tools, never meant to see the light of day. But they weren't enough for this mission. That's why you're here. Why Rokos and the rest of your crew are here. And Riley? Kyle asked. Is she unstable? No more than you, Captain, Glass told him. Like you, she compartmentalizes the violence in her life away from her ethics and sense of being a good person. We all tell ourselves lies about what kind of people we are. Riley is good at believing hers. You are not making me comfortable with this, Kyle replied. You are a soldier, Captain. Do you expect to be comfortable with your job? Russell stood at the edge of the flight deck, watching his people exit the starfighters after another grueling round of exercises. Exercises that would not have been made easier by wondering just what the hell had happened last night. It only took a few seconds for the crews close enough to him to see him and start crowding toward him, a cacophony of questions following only moments behind. Please, he told them, raising his hands. Give me a moment for everyone to get here. The sound had served the purpose of attracting everyone's attention, and Russell hopped up onto a nearby pile of sturdy-looking hardware as the rest of the wing gathered around. The muttering only increased as his people gathered around and got a look at the bandages covering half of his face and hand. I'm sure the rumor mill has done its usual job of attempting to turn simple facts into grand conspiracies and dramatic tales, he said loudly as the last few men and women trickled in. It's relatively obvious, though, that something did happen, as this is a little big for cutting myself shaving. The sad truth is that Flight Commander Cavendish attempted to murder me last night, he explained, his words cutting the last few muttered conversations to silence. She succeeded in murdering Junior Lieutenant Gianna Cavalcante and badly injuring Junior Lieutenant Raul Alvarado. He felt absolutely no qualms at blaming Cavendish for Alvarado's injuries. It had been her bullets he'd thrown the younger man aside to protect him from. Raul will recover in time to fly and fight at Tau Ceti, he promised everyone. But Commander Cavendish refused to surrender when Marines intervened and was killed. So were a Marine she'd co-opted and Junior Lieutenant Carlisle, he told them. Four people died aboard Chameleon last night. Our people, killed by our people. He paused to let that sink in. Half of you were with me and the captain on Avalon at Alizon and Barsoom, he said softly. This isn't the first time we've seen someone turn on our own for reasons we don't understand. It's not easy to deal with, and it's not something we should have to deal with, but we'll do it. In less than 10 days, this starfighter wing goes into battle, Russell reminded his people. We can't afford to get hung up on the whys and wherefores. We have to do our job. The message wasn't sinking entirely home, he could tell, but he had good people. They'd step up. First off, it's looking like our plan in Tau Ceti is going to involve the starfighters pretending to be Commonwealth birds until the rocket goes up. The Commonwealth's Starfighter Corps uses a 10-ship squadron. To fake being them, we're going to do the same. That it was also helpful in making up for his suddenly lacking squadron commander went unspoken but understood. We're also going to start running through some Terran scenarios we've acquired, he warned them. Their policies, procedures, and default tactics are different than ours, and the last thing I'm going to put up with is blowing the captain's nice shiny plan because one of us answered the radio Roger when Terran pilots use understood. Do you get me? Chapter 37. Deep Space, under Alcubierre Drive. 1300, June 12th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon.
You really do seem to pick up the crazy women who want to kill your cag, don't you?
Mira Salas said with a grin Kyle could tell was forced.
Is Rokos okay?
I think he's more shaken than he's letting on, Kyle admitted, glad that Mira's ship was sufficiently clear of active operations, for the moment, for them to have a live conversation. His wound was pretty significant. It'll regenerate quickly, at least, but he also lost one of his flight crew. That's hard for starfighter people. Our crew are family.
I can think of a certain ex-starfighter officer who didn't lose that attitude when they picked up a much bigger ship, the elegant black woman teased. How are you holding up?
Pissed, he answered. Not much I can do about it, though. She's dead and we're going into action.
Chameleon was only about 24 hours from going into full communication lockdown herself. This would be the last time they spoke before he reached Tau Ceti, and there was so much he couldn't say. He couldn't, for that matter, even tell her when he was going in communications lockdown. Things are quiet here, she told him, clearly following some of his thoughts. Intel says Walking Stick is playing at keeping us busy all along the front until he gets the reinforcements they figure he's been promised.
I don't trust that man to be doing what it appears he's doing, Kyle told her. The last time they'd thought they'd known what Walking Stick was doing, the Terran Admiral's local commander had sucker-punched an entire system's defenses out behind them.
Neither do I, his lover agreed. And neither does Alstairs, which is why I'm spending 6 hours a day making sure Cameron is ready for war, and another 6 in strategy planning meetings. At least I get to talk to my sister, and occasionally you, to break the monotony, she said with a smile.
How's your sister? He asked.
She is very bright, very enthusiastic, and very 15, Mira replied. She mostly understands what being on deployment means, but she still keeps asking when I can bring you home to meet her. She has a bad case of hero worship going on for the Stellar Fox.
Kyle sighed. I keep revisiting the potential plan of beating journalists up in dark alleys until they stop using that name, he noted.
It's entered the popular mind now. You're doomed, she told him. What about your family?
I can talk to you because you're a Navy captain and are presumed to have a sense of discretion, he said quietly. The Navy is not so generous in its assumptions when it comes to neural physicians and 12-year-old boys. We get to trade letters when I'm this deep.
That said, they're doing fine. Like most of his generation now, Jacob is Navy mad and wants me to sign his models of every ship from 7th Fleet when I get home.
Kyle shook his head, the thought bringing up something of a smile.
I can't quite get myself past just how inaccurate the official licensed models are, he told Mira. Proportions are off, numbers of visible weapons are off. Gods, I don't think they gave the Ursine-class carriers flight decks. You, my dear captain, are a purist.
And you clearly don't understand how bad a portrayal of our poor ships these models are, Kyle pointed out. I mean, I understand it's for security, but they could have at least tried.
She was laughing aloud at him now, and he gave her as big a grin as he could manage.
I look forward to introducing you to them, he told her.
His was a strange life, or not introducing his new girlfriend to his ex was basically impossible. Unless he wanted to remove Jacob from his life again, which he did not, Lisa Kerensky was also going to be a part of his life. I look forward to it, Mira told him. Even meeting Lisa. From the sounds of it, I'm in more trouble if I don't live up to her standards for you than if I missed yours.
She went and found herself a member of the Federation Assembly to date, Kyle pointed out. What's a mere Navy captain?
She shook her head, glancing away as she did. My next meeting is rushing up on me, she admitted. Kyle, take care of yourself. I'll be pissed if you don't come back.
Orders received and understood, ma'am, he told her with a crisp salute.
With that and a blown kiss, He let the channel close and considered his desk. Time to work on making sure everyone came back. Edvard gestured Riley to a seat across from his desk, trying to assess his subordinate's mood as she sat. Her face was locked down again, hiding her thoughts from everyone. "How's your platoon?" he asked. Ostensibly, this was the same check-in meeting he was having with his other two platoon commanders, but they both knew it was more than that. After rearranging things, all of his platoons were down half a squad, and his 20-trooper headquarters section was only 13 strong.
"Pissed at Assam," Riley said flatly. "But they're on the job. This kind of shit is..."
She sighed.
"I'd say a lot more common in Black Ops units than regular Marines, but let's be honest, it happens in Black Ops units and doesn't in the Marines. The kind of guys and gals you put in a unit like mine are not good people, Edvard," she warned him. "My job is as much to keep these idiots from stabbing everyone else in the back as it is training or pointing them at the enemy."
Edvard shook his head, trying to envisage any unit that was that difficult. "How do your units even function?" he asked.
"They keep it out of the unit in the main," she replied. "They work together in action, follow orders, do what they're ordered. And then, when we're off duty, they turn into a bunch of prima donnas who'll stab anyone outside the unit who looks at them cross-eyed."
"Like Cavendish," Edvard noted. "How are you holding up?"
"I fucked up and had to kill one of my few actual friends because of it," Riley snapped. "How do you expect me to be holding up?"
"Like shit," he said frankly. "It's not your fault.
Bullshit. The captain said what a captain says when he's letting a junior officer who shouldn't know better off the hook," Riley replied. "I was pulled from the Corps for Black Ops when you were in boot, Hansen. I know what kind of psychopaths we have in unmarked uniforms. I knew what Cavendish was. Chilling sign of how used you are to people who kill at the drop of a hat when most of your close friends fit that bill, isn't it? I knew what she was. I knew she wouldn't let it lie at complaints, but I said nothing because she was a friend,"
Riley said bitterly.
"I let my personal feelings compromise my professional judgment, and I should have known better."
"So did I," Edvard snapped.
"You told me you had suspicions. It was my job to yank you up short and order you to act on them. I didn't because of our frankly dangerous feelings toward each other."
That admission shut her up. It was the first time either of them had admitted anything aloud to the other. But he knew, and he knew she knew, and so on and so forth.
"Yes, you fucked up," he told her gently. "But if I'd assessed the risk differently, I would have pressured you to come clean.
I didn't.
A lot of people had to misjudge Cavendish's limits for it to go this far. I need you on point, on duty, and 100%, so that we all get to come home alive. I do not need you beating yourself up for your failures. Can you do that for me, Sandra? Can you let this go and do the job?"
She inhaled sharply, the mask cracking into unshed tears for a long moment before she nodded and inhaled again.
"I think so. Just promise me one thing, sir."
"This isn't a negotiation, Lieutenant," Edvard pointed out.
"Not that kind of promise, Edvard," she replied. "Promise me you'll live through this, too."
"I have no intention of dying this far from home, Sandra. It's war, and we won't all make it home. But I plan on bringing as many of my people home as possible."
"Our target in the Tau Ceti system is threefold," Kyle summarized to the gathered officers in the planning room. A massive hologram filled the center of the room, showing the two habitable worlds and heavy spaceborne industry of Tau Ceti. "Firstly, we need to board the TCN Central Research Station here." An icon flashed in orbit of the second gas giant. There was slightly less traffic around the ninth planet than around the larger eighth, but it was a relative matter.
The massive Navy facilities orbiting Tau Ceti H more than made up for the much reduced civilian traffic. Tau Ceti H was the quietest part of the system. It was still busier than anywhere Kyle had ever seen except the castle system itself. Dozens of cloud scoops provided a constant stream of fuel for the slightly safer fusion plants that fueled the massive shipyards and the civilian support infrastructure. "The Central Research Station is now our primary objective," he told his people. "We will do our best to insert Riley's people without compromising our cover. Every minute we can give them to operate on the station without triggering a system-wide security alert increases our chances of retrieving the data we're after. To help distract everyone from Riley's attack, we will be using Rokos's starfighters to launch as covert a strike as we can manage at Shipyard Alpha." A second station, this one a massive agglomeration of yard slips, construction gantries, and half-assembled ships, highlighted in the hologram. It formed a rough spindle shape, a wide circular top hosting the shipyards and their incomplete children, with a sharp spike hanging down to link to the pontoon-like hexagon of pods with stabilizer thrusters that held the whole structure up against Tau Ceti H's gravity. The scale on the hologram happily informed everyone that Shipyard Alpha was over 50 kilometers across and 70 high, the single largest man-made structure in the star system. "Shipyard Alpha single-handedly represents 40% of the construction capacity in this system, and roughly 1.2% of the military construction capacity of the Commonwealth," he explained. "It also has a lot of non-combatant personnel aboard, and is a massive target. A direct assault on the facility would be an arguable war crime, one I am not prepared to countenance, regardless of the level of secrecy cloaking this operation." Despite the size of the station, such an assault would be far from futile. He'd run the numbers in private. If the estimate on the defenses was correct, a full salvo from all 40 of their starfighters would punch through the defensive suites and deliver more than enough firepower on target to vaporize the entire station. Along with about 120,000 people, less than 10% of whom were even uniformed Navy personnel, let alone combatants. "Depending on where in their approach we trigger the system alarm, the wing will use their missiles to destroy the orbiting defense platforms and close with the station to launch precision positron lance strikes," Kyle continued. "There are 12 capital ships in various stages of construction, including two Volcano-class supercarriers that our intelligence suggests are mere months from deployment." 12 capital ships was more than all but four members of the Alliance fielded. They could destroy an entire Navy's worth of ships in a single strike, and they would only mildly inconvenience the Commonwealth. "Our third objective is to terrify the Commonwealth," he said calmly. "We want them looking over their shoulders for the monsters in the night. We want them blaming the League for pirates and condottieri breaking down their doors. We are striking at the very heart of the Commonwealth's military machine." One of several such hearts, but that was beside the point. "We want them to be afraid, in a way the Commonwealth has never known fear." He smiled coldly at his people. "That's the plan, ladies and gentlemen. We have 9 days until we have to execute it. By then, I want us to have gone over every way we can think of it breaking. We're going to test and war game every scenario we can think of. We're pretending to be condottieri, after all, which means we need to be thinking about our return on investment." Chapter 38. Deep Space, under Alcubierre Drive. 2030, June 14th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon. Wing Commander Russell Rokos watched his exhausted flight crews shuffle slowly off the flight deck, keeping his face utterly impassive as he watched them go. It would never do, after all, for them to realize the taskmaster whipping them along was actually extremely pleased with their progress. He was planning a break for them, giving them a half day off and some positive words. It would be a surprise to most of them.
He tried to be constructively critical, but they were still doing a lot wrong.
"So, Keg, have they stopped blowing each other up in simulations yet?"
the captain asked cheerfully from behind him.
"We managed to progress past that stage relatively quickly," Russell told him, "though I'll admit I was expecting it to take us longer to get there. Your Navy people have set to with a will, and their skill sets transfer better than we were afraid they would."
"Shall we chat in your office?" the captain replied, revealing the inevitable pair of beers in his other massive hand.
"Catch me up."
Russell grabbed the beer and gestured for his superior to precede him. His office was only slightly farther from his starfighter's flight deck hangar than it was from Pryfly, a sensible design choice in his admittedly biased opinion, and one that was shared between both Terran and Castle warship design. Collapsing into his chair, he popped the beer on his desk and regarded Roberts levelly.
"We're not doing great just yet," he told the captain. "If we put together a single squadron of my Space Force people and gave them Falcons, they'd eat this entire wing alive, but..."
He held up a hand. "They are improving. Rapidly.
I think we've underestimated just how cross-compatible our drones and nano-repair systems are between the Navy versions and the Space Force version. It's the same hardware, software, everything. But we have ourselves half convinced that it's a different skill set. It certainly helps, though, that all of the missileers were cross-trained on fighter missiles because of Chameleon's armament," Russell admitted. "We're not building skills from the ground up in either case, just teaching people how to apply them in new circumstances. Our biggest weakness is going to be ECM. I've kept it to one Navy crew per fighter, and all of our people have some training in ECM, but the only birds that are going to be running jammers and decoys at full power are the ones with Space Force flight engineers."
"But they'll be ready."
"They'll be ready," Russell said in a rush of breath. It was the first time he dared say that aloud. "I was hoping for 70% effectiveness, and I'm thinking we might be as high as 85. Your people sent me good techs."
"Good," the captain rumbled.
"I'd hoped so, but it shows solid judgment from them both. Speaking of my people, though, Taylor's thrown a new wrinkle in the plan."
"And what's that?"
"She thinks we should keep a squadron in Chameleon's tubes for a CSP, Roberts explained. "It gives us more flexibility for a lot of our scenarios, but it cuts your strike force by a quarter."
"It does,"
Russell said, thinking it over.
"It depends on which squadron, really. If I leave you 10 scimitars, that has less of an impact than if I leave the katanas."
"And yet,"
the captain said, letting the sentence hang in the air.
"I intentionally put my least qualified flight teams on the katanas," the CAG admitted. "They're solid fighters, easily the equal of Falcons in a lot of ways. The less experienced crews weaken that squadron, but using the better fighters to offset the weaker crews gives me the strongest wing."
"What are you thinking, CAG?"
"If I leave you the katanas, that gives you the most flexibility possible in defending Chameleon, which is, I may point out, our only ride home,"
Russell said thoughtfully.
"It will also likely be easier to hide a 3-squadron task force in the background of system traffic if they're a homogeneous force. I doubt the Commonwealth deploys mixed groups for in-system patrols."
"And you can complete the mission with the scimitars?"
"The mission becomes impossible to complete if Shipyard Alpha goes to full alert," Russell replied. "It's not going to matter whether or not I have an extra 10 fighters when that happens. If we can't close to use lances, our options are to run or commit a war crime."
"That is not on the table," Robert said flatly.
"Then I suspect the katanas will be more valuable as our ace in the hole than as another set of positron lances to rip up Shipyard Alpha."
The captain took a giant swallow of beer.
"I wasn't going to argue if you said you needed them," he noted with a grin. "But I know I'm going to be happier with that whole card than without it."
1400, June 18th, 2736, ESMDT. Russell was one of the first people out of the starfighters this time as they broke for lunch,
making sure he was in position to watch his flight crew's reaction as they exited their ships to find the center of the flight deck turned into a banquet hall. While his people had been immersed in their virtual realities for the last 6 hours, as they'd done for the first half of every day in the 8 days since the fighter wing had been reorganized, Master Chief Hans had marshaled a small legion of the ship's stewards. A dozen long tables had been laid out, as had chairs and massive piles of food and drink. At the front of the whole ensemble was a small dais with a podium, and Russell walked over to it as his people stumbled to a halt, staring at the meal laid out for them.
"It's real, people," he told them as he stepped onto the platform. "Please grab a seat, grab a plate, and dig in."
The crowd obeyed, slowly at first, then with alacrity as they started to catch on. Drinks and plates started to be passed around as the crews fell on the food like ravenous wolves.
"So as any of the veterans can tell you, I'm a hard man to get praise out of," Russell told them once they were seated and eating. "You've done well, better than I expected even, so I'm giving you all the rest of the day off. We've been beating our heads against this wall for a week. We can't do 12-hour days forever and then go into action, not and expect victory. Report back to your starfighter at 0800 tomorrow and do not get in trouble until then. Enjoy the food and get some rest. You've earned it."
Stepping down from the platform, he grabbed a plate of food of his own and slid into a chair next to Churchill.
"Ready to be wrapped in a silk glove?" he asked the squadron commander quietly.
"Is that what you call handing me every green pilot we have?" Churchill replied, his voice equally quiet as he glanced around to be sure no one could hear them.
"Chameleon needs a punch no one is expecting. A mailed gauntlet in a silk glove," Russell pointed out. "That's going to be your Alpha Squadron, and you got the katanas out of the deal. Don't complain about your pilots."
"I'm not complaining about my pilots. They're good people," the other man objected.
"But no pilot in my squadron except me actually has their wings, Cag." "And that's the other reason I'm willing to leave you as the backup," Russell admitted. "The katanas give you the punch if you're needed, but if you're not, we don't have to risk your people."
"Do we really think we're going to get through this mess without needing backup?" Churchill asked.
"No. Which is why I want you to drill your people even harder than everyone else. When everything inevitably goes to shit, you'll be the ones the Fox has to hand for whatever crazy idea will pull us out of the fire. I need your people able to pull that idea off. Think you can manage that?"
"Wilco,"
Churchill said grimly, glancing around at his crews.
"We'll make it happen."
Chapter 39. Tau Ceti System. 1800, June 21st, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon, approaching Tau Ceti H. The last of the uniforms had been packed away, destroyed in case the worst came to pass, in fact, and Kyle's bridge was filled with officers and enlisted in unmarked black ship suits. There were no merchant marine hats this time. The deception to come would be played out with computers and avatars, not his own theatrical abilities. The room was utterly silent, unusual even in this era of neural networks and in-head displays. Everyone was focused on the main holographic display as Lau guided them in the last few seconds of Alcubierre Drive, and then collapsed the space warp.
"Arrival,"
the taciturn navigator announced into the silence. Kyle refrained, by dint of great effort, from demanding an instant sit-rep. Taylor's people would have been working the instant the warp dropped, and they started to receive current light from the system. Live data began to propagate on the holo display, rippling out in a spherical pattern around Chameleon as Taylor's people focused on the closest potential threats first.
"Chownik, how's our IFF?" he asked, watching the display carefully as man-made objects began to appear on the display.
Even in a system as rich as Tau Ceti, there were only a small number of warships, just one in Tau Ceti H orbit, in fact, though he presumed there were more over the two habitable worlds. but he could see multiple squadron strength or more starfighter patrols and dozens of the in-system clippers that would fuel an industrialized systems economy. Any one of those could doom the entire operation if they saw Chameleon as anything except a Commonwealth Navy vessel.
"Everything is checking out from here," his XO replied. "We are TCNS Christopher Lee to everyone looking. If there's some trick to their IFF codes, though."
"We're running their code on their hardware," Kyle pointed out. "If that won't work, this whole operation was doomed from the beginning."
"The good lieutenant is ready to go," Glass told him,
the spy having taken over the communications console on the bridge to allow him to run the simulacrum that would hopefully get them close enough to finish the mission.
"Thank you,"
Kyle replied, then turned back to Taylor.
"All right, tactical, what do we see?"
"Shipyard Alpha and the Central Research Station are exactly where they should be," she replied. "We have a Saint-class battleship orbiting Shipyard Charlie, roughly 40 light seconds from the area of operations. Defenses for both Alpha and the research station match up to our intel. I've got just over 300 starfighters running security patrol through the Tau Ceti H planetary system and local space, but none of them are within 2 million kilometers of us at this moment."
"Any other warships?"
"Two Lexington-class carriers and two Assassin-class battlecruisers are attached to a resupply station halfway between the two habitable planets," she reported. "They're the main system defense force, but they're also over a day from H."
Though with the various defenses around the gas giant, the battleship, and the 1,000-plus starfighters swanning around the system, the main system fleet arriving a day late to the party wasn't going to change the odds.
"We're looking as clear as we're going to get," Kyle said aloud. "Commander Rokos."
"I'm seeing it,"
Rokos replied.
"Your orders?"
"You have a go to drop 10 minutes before we hit turnover," the captain ordered. That was still just over an hour away, and they'd still be almost 10 million kilometers from the research station, 13 million from Shipyard Alpha.
"All right," Rokos confirmed. "Plenty of time for us to get dropped off like garbage. See you on the other side, Skipper. Good luck."
"Good luck to you, too. Happy hunting."
"Not the moment of truth just yet,"
Kyle said cheerfully as the channel cut. "Any reaction to our presence in general?"
"Tau Ceti Traffic Control just sent out a handshake request from an automated sensor platform," Chownik reported from CIC. "We fed it into the old software and sent it back a response. I give it a few minutes before anyone realizes the QCOM address doesn't work anymore."
The pirates who'd stolen what had then been Christopher Lee had destroyed her original quantum entangled particle blocks within hours of seizing her. Inconvenient to Kyle now, though the current mix of League, Alliance, and Black quantum blocks she carried was certainly secure enough. He had Commonwealth quantum blocks, but they weren't Christopher Lee's, which made them useless today.
"Your friend is going to be up in a few minutes," Kyle told Glass, considering.
How long would depend on who made the call to reach out by radio, and who actually did the reaching out?
"That's what we have him for," the spy said confidently.
The seconds ticked away, each carrying the Q-ship thousands of kilometers closer to her destination, accelerating towards their turnover point at a sedate 100 gravities. Kyle could imagine the consternation going on in Tau Ceti space traffic control. They were flying a Navy IFF, though the STC might have it listed as lost in action. They were doing nothing offensive. They had correctly replied to the radio handshake, but the QCOM connection they preferred to use for final setup was valid, but coming up blank.
"We have an incoming radio transmission,"
Chownik reported.
"Throw it on the holotank. Do not record for reply," Kyle ordered.
The big system display in the holographic tank flickered, and a flat video image appeared off to one side. The sole occupant of the image was a middle-aged woman in the black and red uniform of the Terran Commonwealth Navy.
"This is Captain Alice Nguyen, TCN," she said harshly. "Tau Ceti System Control has flagged you as a potential threat.
Christopher Lee, you are on our records as lost in action, details classified, and your QCOM blocks are not functional. Identify and explain, or I will be forced to deploy starfighters to destroy you.
Nguyen's image froze as the transmission ended, and Kyle waved airily at Glass.
You're up, Mr. Glass. How's the good lieutenant feeling?
Mr. Adelaide's come a long way at great cost and is almost home, the spy replied brightly. He's stressed, but relieved. Let's see what he has to say.
Lieutenant Pierre Adelaide was a young man with pitch-black skin and hair from the Proxima Centauri colony. He had also been the assistant tactical officer aboard Christopher Lee when she'd been captured by pirates, and had still been alive when Federation Marines had stormed the Q-ship. Adelaide was a loyal son of the Commonwealth, but he was also very grateful to no longer be the personal sex slave of a woman who was the poster child for psychopathic slaver. Regardless of whether or not he'd knowingly given the Alliance any classified information, Federation intelligence had a lot of video footage of the young man. The image that appeared on a new video screen on the holographic display was a digital simulacrum assembled from that footage, one that would say and do exactly what Glass instructed in exactly the way that young Adelaide would. He stood on a bridge that was in much worse shape than the one Kyle sat on. The command chair was gone, and many of the consoles had been replaced by jury-rigged stopgaps. The space was the painstaking kind of clean that only happened in the mess after true disasters, where real clean was impossible. Those stopgap consoles just happened to be facing away from the camera Adelaide was looking into, and none of the half-dozen people in shabby ship suits on the young officer's bridge had faces visible in the transmission.
"This is Lieutenant Pierre Adelaide, acting captain of Christopher Lee," the simulacrum said in a voice that mixed exhaustion and relief. "As you yourself said, Captain Nguyen, exact details of Lee's mission are classified. But we were captured by pirates and my superiors were all killed. The pirates destroyed the QCOM blocks and flew Christopher Lee as a pirate for some weeks before I and the remaining crew managed to escape and retake the ship. I owe my life to the brave specialists and Marines who risked everything to break out," he continued. "We've managed enough repairs to get the ship flying, but without the Q-blocks we had no ability to call home. Adelaide swallowed. "Our orders were not to reveal Christopher Lee's existence to anyone unnecessarily and to return to Tau Ceti. We are not in need of medical assistance," he said carefully, "but I am not confident of Lee's ability to sustain acceleration or to create another Alcubierre bubble. We have a package to be hand-delivered to the Central Research Station, but then I must request a slip at one of the shipyards for major repairs."
The image froze.
"Message sent," Glass reported. "Any idea on turnaround time?"
"Captain Nguyen is on one of the defensive platforms around Shipyard Alpha," Chownik reported. "We're still a full light minute away, so a minimum 2-minute turnaround even if she's authorized to make the call on her own."
2 minutes passed in silence. Kyle kept up his usual cheery appearance, though he doubted he was the only one on the bridge who wanted to hold their breath. This was the first moment of truth, one of the points where the entire plan would come apart if the Commonwealth didn't buy it. 5 minutes passed.
"We are at emergence plus 20 minutes, Taylor announced quietly. "We are 45 minutes from starfighter deployment, 90 from closest approach to the research station."
Kyle didn't say anything in response, waiting and watching. None of the fighter squadrons patrolling the star system were moving toward them, which was a positive sign, but without some kind of response.
"Incoming transmission," Chownik reported, almost 15 minutes after they'd sent their message. "This one is coming from the research station itself."
A different Terran officer appeared on the screen. This one a tall man with darkly tanned skin, and a short black braid hanging down over his right ear. He wore the same uniform as Captain Nguyen, except with the 2 gold stars of a Commonwealth rear admiral.
"This is Admiral Alec Cornsilk,"
he said. Captain Nguyen relayed your transmission to me, and I apologize for the delay, Lieutenant Adelaide. I cannot imagine what it cost for you to retake your ship and return all this way. Welcome home.
The Admiral's clear, honest enthusiasm and warmth left Kyle feeling guilty. Everything they had told the Terrans was a lie. Less than 50 of Christopher Lee's crew had still been aboard when she'd been recaptured. The brave specialists and marines their simulacrum had praised were, in the main, dead.
Continue on your course for Shipyard Alpha, Cornsilk ordered. I'm informed we should have a slip free for Christopher Lee to slot into for repairs. You said you had a package to deliver to my station. If you have a shuttle you can send over, I'll have someone waiting to meet you. Once you've docked, get in touch with my staff, the Admiral instructed. We will need to debrief you. And after the kind of trip you've just had, I'll want to do that over the best meal I can find.
The image froze, and Kyle smiled.
Much as it pains me to do a disservice to such a kind Admiral, he said aloud. He seems to have given us the open door we need. Let's have the good lieutenant deliver the appropriate kind of thanks. Then let's get ready to drop Rokos's fighters. We are now at launch minus 33 minutes.
Russell watched through his starfighter's sensors as the massive cargo hatches at the end of the flight bay slid open. Normally, the two doors were sequenced to open and close one after the other. In a time lapse so short humans barely registered it, to allow starfighters to leave or board the ship with the minimum loss of atmosphere. Now, with every loose object secured and the support staff evacuated, both doors slid open at Chief Hans's command. The starfighter handling systems, designed to operate in vacuum as an emergency measure, gently removed the scimitars from their hangar bays four at a time and set them loose, letting them drift out into deep space with the escaping air. The wing commander tried not to hold his breath. This wasn't necessarily the most dangerous part of the operation, but it was the one where everything could go wrong. There were enough different fighter groups and commands in the star system, he agreed with the assessment that once they were in and flying, everyone would assume they belonged to everyone else. The most likely failure point was when they brought their engines online, but the scimitars weren't the stealth fighters Cavendish had brought along. They had no way to hide their internal heat, no smart hulls to blend them into the background. If anyone was looking with a telescope, what they were doing would be obvious.
Your turn, sir,
Hans told him as the robotic Waldos locked onto his ship.
While I have to confess I'm not overly fond of these Terran birds, I do quite like their crews. Do try and bring everyone home, sir.
They both knew that wasn't going to happen. Starfighter wings always took losses, often brutal ones. Even with the limited population fit to fly starfighters, any star system could replace pilots and fighters far more easily than the astronomically expensive starships they launched from. And this mission was going to be hell.
I'll just have a quick chat with the Terrans, explain that we just need to steal some data and blow a fleet's worth of warships to the void, and then we can all go home, he told her dryly. I'm sure they'll be completely on board with just letting us get things done.
She snorted.
I've never met anyone whose tongue was that silver, sir. Shoot straight.
The Waldos released him, and his scimitar drifted down the deck. A few seconds later, and his ship was in space, drifting along with the rest of his wing. The last pair of fighters followed him out, and he had a 30-strong strike force drifting through space at the same velocity as their mothership. Chameleon was heading toward turnover on a straightforward and obvious vector toward Shipyard Alpha. She'd pass by the research station on the way at a perfectly safe 1,000 kilometers a second, about 10 minutes before the starfighters, which would not decelerate, reached Shipyard Alpha itself 3 million kilometers farther on. Turnover. Chameleon flipped in space, the spherical ship rotating to bring her massive antimatter thrusters to bear in the opposite direction. Superheated energetic particles washed forward, creating a powerful wake of radiation that preceded the Q-ship at light speed. The perfect shield to hide behind.
moments after the Q-ship started throwing dry fumes out toward every sensor in orbit of Tau Ceti H, the 30 scimitars behind her lit off their own engines and began to accelerate toward Shipyard Alpha. This time, Kyle was holding his breath. They'd fooled the Terrans with their electronic simulacrum, and it appeared the deployment of the starfighters, now 60,000 kilometers behind them as Chameleon continued to accelerate towards turnover, had gone unnoticed. If anyone was feeling suspicious, the sudden appearance of a 3-squadron patrol behind the new ship would set alarm bells ringing. While those alarm bells should only trigger a query initially, they still needed over 35 minutes, and answering that query would only buy them a handful. This was the single biggest risk of the plan, and Kyle was relying on an error that had been repeated hundreds of times since its most famous occurrence at Pearl Harbor on Earth. Since the only fighters that could possibly be in Tau Ceti were Commonwealth, any fighter seen had to be Commonwealth. That they were flying Terran-designed starfighters would help, though the whole deception would come crashing down if they tried to interrogate more than Rokos's fighter by QCOM. The presence of a legitimate Terran Q-block was too risky for them to leave them in place on more than one ship. Seconds ticked by.
"This is strike actual," Rokos reported. "We are online and headed for Shipyard Alpha. No challenges detected as yet. Keeping the QCOM online and watching for new friends."
Kyle glanced over at Taylor, who gave him a slow, hesitant nod.
"We show you clear as well, strike actual," he replied. "Radio silence until the rocket goes up now. Chameleon out."
There was, quite appropriately, no response. Kyle opened another link.
"Major Hansen, we have official approval to send over a shuttle," he told the Marine. "Are your people ready?"
"I'll be going over with Lieutenant Riley's platoon, and the remainder of the company is standing by for heavy assault if we can launch in time."
"Numbers say you have barely 5 minutes after landing till Rokos raises hell," Kyle warned him. "Are you up for it?"
"Ve victis, Captain,"
Hansen threw the condottieri's motto at him.
"We will overcome, no matter who you ask us to pretend to be."
"We have no margin, Lieutenant Major," Kyle said quietly. "We need the plans for those new starfighters."
"There's only so much I can do with 5 minutes, boss," Hansen replied, his tone equally quiet. "And we're more likely to trigger alarms than anyone else now."
"We'll have your heavy assault right behind you when you do," Chameleon's captain promised. "If we can steal it quietly, I'm not complaining. But once it goes hot, it's smash and grab. We need those plans. At all costs."
"Understood," Hansen acknowledged grimly.
Chapter 40. Tau Ceti System. 1945, June 21st, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian, date, time. Chameleon, Assault Shuttle 3. Edvard had his eyes closed as the assault shuttle decelerated hard toward the Terran space station. While he had the high implant bandwidth compatibility necessary to be a military officer in the 28th century, though not enough to be starfighter crew by any stretch, he found that having his eyes closed helped deal with multiple implant stimuli. Right now, he was watching the entire star system through the shuttle's sensors. Without data they intentionally didn't have on the shuttle, he wasn't certain which of the patrols swanning around Tau Ceti H was their own strike team.
"Contact in 4 minutes," the pilot announced over the PA.
"Check your gear," Riley snapped.
Even with his eyes closed, Edvard knew what the scene in the shuttle's main compartment would look like. The Black Ops platoon was in low-profile body armor that could pass for ship suits except under close inspection. It wouldn't stop a battle armor penetrator, but would stand off a few regular rounds. The second wave was packing anti-armor carbines, just in case, but the first squad carried the kind of light arms that might pass without too much comment. Riley and her computer specialists carried only sidearms, as did Edvard himself.
"I don't actually need a babysitter, you know," Riley told him over a private implant link. "This is my ballgame now. I know the plays better than you do.
I know, he admitted. But it's my responsibility, and I'm the one who has to make the call on the follow-up assault. I'll try not to jog your elbow.
I appreciate it, she said. But if you get yourself killed on this damn fool endeavor, I will never forgive you.
Opening his eyes to avoid visibly shaking his head, Edvard drew and checked the safety and magazine on his sidearm while he arched an eyebrow at her.
We both have a job to do, he told her as he slid the mag back in with a sharp click. Let's leave anything else until afterwards.
Riley chuckled, the first part of the conversation audible to anyone else around them.
I'm taking that as a promise, boss.
The assault shuttle settled calmly to the deck of the space station's landing bay, a far cry from many of Edvard's recent experiences with landing the small spacecraft. Rising, the Marine checked his intentionally haphazardly fabricated Terran Commonwealth Navy petty officer chevrons and picked up the courier case at his feet. Riley and three of her electronic specialist troopers, wearing the equally crudely made insignia of a Terran Commonwealth Marine Corps corporal and privates, fell in around him as they exited the shuttle. The carefully shielded hull of the assault craft would prevent the station's sensors from realizing just how packed full it was with the rest of Riley's platoon. The landing bay was surprisingly small and Spartan, with only one other shuttle and a single exit deeper into the station. The walls presumably held compartments with refueling gear and so forth, but the only visible break was a window allowing a flight control officer to overlook the bay. Edvard presumed the three people standing next to the exit were the welcoming party and made a beeline for them. The leader of the party, a tall, pale-skinned woman with the single gold bar of a Commonwealth Marine Corps major, met him halfway with a crisp salute that Edvard's assumed rank did not deserve. The story of Adelaide's brave escape had clearly spread.
Major Armstrong, she introduced herself. I understand you have a package for us, P.O.
I do, Edvard confirmed, lifting the courier case.
I have no idea what it contains, he admitted cheerfully. But the skipper said the orders he found on the old captain's computers said to deliver it to the Starfighter Research Department here.
I can deliver it for you, Armstrong said calmly. You're not cleared to go farther into the station.
People died for us to get this back, Edvard said quietly. Adelaide ordered me to see it delivered myself.
The data chips in the case were actually full of garbage data, but that was hidden under one of the Commonwealth's top-level ciphers from a year earlier. But that was reasonable, given when the then Christopher Lee had left.
I appreciate both Lieutenant Adelaide's concern and your orders, the Terran Marine said gently. But I have no authority to allow you on the station. I need you to give me the case and return to Christopher Lee.
There went that part of the plan, though Edvard had never put that much faith in it.
Can we at least grab a bite to eat? He asked plaintively. We've been on reprocessed ration bars for weeks.
The recycling systems on a warship were fantastically efficient things, but no crew voluntarily went onto reprocessed ration bars. The taste was surprisingly tolerable, but no one could get out of their minds just where the bars came from. Armstrong winced but shook her head.
I can recommend a place on Shipyard Alpha, she said apologetically, holding her hand out for the case. But this is a Class 1 facility. I can't let you aboard.
Edvard mentally checked the time. Still 4 minutes before the fighters were in range, but he'd run this conversation out as long as he could.
That's unfortunate, he told Armstrong aloud, and sent the go signal to Riley and his people through the implant.
He didn't even see Riley move. There was a flash of motion, and Armstrong was down, her trachea crushed by an iron-hard fist to the throat, and her legs swept out from underneath her. The Terran officer likely didn't even realize she was under attack before Riley had killed her. Her escorts didn't last any longer. Their lifespans extended by fractions of a second only because they'd been hanging back, and it had taken the Black Ops cyborg slightly longer to reach them.
Go, go, go!
Edvard shouted aloud,
shoving his shock at the speed and brutality of the deaths aside. He'd seen sudden death before, if not like this. The rest of the platoon heard the order and came boiling out of the shuttle. But even as they did so, the emergency shutters on the flight control booth slammed shut. Edvard was already linking into the QCOM aboard the shuttle.
"Rocket! Rocket! Rocket!"
he announced to Chameleon and Commander Rokos.
"Station security didn't buy the story. Launch the second wave. We're moving on the bay flight control to locate a data center."
He paused.
"Good luck."
Heavy security shutters had slammed shut over the exit as well. But while Edvard had been letting everyone else know the shooting had started, the Black Ops troopers had been pulling out a bipod-mounted rocket launcher. One of the troopers slammed a long box magazine into the top and stepped away to clear the space behind it, waving aside a trooper who'd misjudged the danger zone. A second soldier braced the launcher's bipod against his torso and aimed the weapon. A moment later, the whole assemblage spewed fire as it salvoed four rockets in under a second. The smart weapons slammed into the shutter covering the bay flight control window in a neatly calculated pattern and detonated their shaped charges, reducing the entire security shutter and a significant chunk of the surrounding metal wall to shards of debris that swept the control center. By the time those explosions had ceased, a second salvo rippled out of the launcher. These four fragmented into submunitions at a pre-calculated distance, each rocket delivering five magnetically tipped grapples to the intact wall above the shattered window. Each grapple then spun out 20 meters of cable, dropping the less than 10 meters to the ground where Charlie Platoon's first squad was waiting. They swarmed up the ropes and threw the massive hole into the control center. There was no gunfire. If anyone had survived the first salvo of rockets, they weren't crazy enough to get into a fight with the Black Ops cyborgs.
"Here!"
one of the troopers exiting the shuttle shouted to Edvard before tossing him an anti-armor carbine.
"Going up, sir?"
"Yes," he replied, gesturing for the third squad sergeant to come to him as the second squad went up the ropes.
"Alpha and Bravo platoons are 2 minutes out at top speed," he told that worthy in command of a squad half made up of Black Ops troops and half of Edvard's headquarters section Marines. "Hold this launch bay. It's our main way home."
"Yes, sir."
With a firm nod to the man, Edvard joined Riley and scaled the rope after the Black Ops squads, only slightly more sedately. He might lack their hardware, but he was still one of Castle's damned Marines.
"We're in control,"
one of the data specialists told him. Somewhere between killing Armstrong's guards and arriving there, she'd produced a forearm-mounted slab of circuitry he recognized as a hacking module, and that module was linked into the wreckage of the center's systems.
"Can you access the station's systems?"
"Negative,"
the hacker replied.
"It looks like each research department has their own secure data center, sir."
"Oh, void," Edvard spat.
"Find me the fighter research data center, Kismet," he ordered the Lance Corporal. "Riley," he shouted, gesturing his platoon commander over. "Get ready for a breakout. We're going to have to punch through to the data center."
"Let's do it,"
she agreed with a cold smile. "Bunch of research pukes? Not a problem."
"Alpha, Bravo," he barked,
linking into his oncoming platoon shuttles.
"Charlie is moving on deep assault. We're leaving one squad to secure the landing bay. Follow in, force a beachhead, and then move out by squads to meet up with us. We have to let the door slam shut behind us," he told them,
looking around at the 40 people he had to punch through a fortified, secured facility in the heart of enemy space.
"I'm going to need you to kick it open again."
Chapter 41. Tau Ceti System. 1955, June 21st, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon.
"Rocket! Rocket! Rocket!"
"Damn,"
Kyle said mildly, watching the security alert wash across the system. With QCOMs tying everything together, the various stations and deployments were reacting within moments of each other, but light-speed delays meant it seemed as if the reaction rippled out from the central research station.
"Incoming transmission,"
Glass reported. The spy threw it up on the main display instantly, revealing yet another new face.
"Christopher Lee,"
the blonde man in the Starfighter Corps uniform drawled.
"This is Wing Colonel John Oklahoma.
We have a security alert where your shuttle touched down. You will abort your approach to Shipyard Alpha, vectoring 90 degrees to Galactic North at your maximum acceleration. You will stand by to receive a Marine inspection party, and you will provide all possible assistance to that party, Oklahoma ordered. If you do not vector as ordered immediately, we will have no choice but to destroy you if you continue on approach to Shipyard Alpha. If you are who you say you are, the officer drawled, this is an unnecessary precaution. But I am responsible for the security of Shipyard Alpha, and I will not put it at risk. You will comply.
The bridge was silent for a fraction of a second. Then Kyle shook his head.
Wouldn't buy us enough time, people, he said aloud. Besides, look.
Shipyard Alpha's immense height was now lit up with dozens, hundreds, of smaller, more intense energy signatures as the station's defenses came online. The orbiting platforms, only semi-somnolent to begin with, now awoke to their full fury. Rokos was going to fly into a hornet's nest, no matter what Chameleon did.
Launch Hansen's shuttles, Kyle barked. Churchill, prep your people to deploy. We're going to keep you in the tubes for a few minutes longer, but we're going to need you. Taylor, get me Q-probe coverage. I don't care if they see it now.
His bridge crew leapt into action, and Kyle watched the entire system explode into action around him. Charlie Platoon had landed 60 people in one assault shuttle, but none had been in battle armor. Even under strength, the other two platoons of Marines were in battle armor. Half were in the even more massive boarding battle armor at that, and filled five assault shuttles. Shuttles that blasted directly at the Central Research Station at 500 gravities. They were going to have rough landings, but that was what assault shuttles in battle armor were built for. A new transmission from Oklahoma arrived unsurprisingly a moment later.
What the hell do you think you're doing, Adelaide? The Terran officer demanded. Recall your shuttles, or I have no choice but to shoot them and you out of my sky.
Taylor? Kyle asked cheerfully. They have nothing in place to intercept the shuttles, she responded. They're clear to the station.
Let Mr. Oklahoma stew in his own sweat, the captain said calmly. Keep our vector on Shipyard Alpha. Watch that battleship and all approaching fighters. This might get hairy.
Harry is right, Glass said.
He'd apparently risen from the comm station and was now standing right behind Kyle's command chair.
Rokos can't make it to Lance Range, Roberts, the spy said. You know it. You also know he'll try to complete the mission, but he'll die and achieve nothing.
Glass was right. Rokos had about another 30 seconds in which he could abort. He was decelerating toward the station, but if he broke and accelerated away from the station at 90 degrees from his current course, he would pass it at 1,000 kilometers a second, well over 100,000 kilometers clear. That was inside the station's range against his ships. But the distance would mean most of his people would survive. If they closed to the 40,000 kilometers necessary for them to precisely target the ships, the defenses would annihilate them.
We have to destroy the station, Glass continued. If they fire all of their missiles, they can take it out. It's a fleet's worth of warships, Roberts. A full percent of the Commonwealth's shipbuilding.
Abort Rokos' strike, Kyle ordered sharply, ignoring the spy.
Damn it, Roberts! We can't let this opportunity pass us by!
The spy snapped, his voice rising in volume now as he realized Kyle wasn't going to instantly obey.
Yes, there's civilians aboard, but it's still a legitimate military target, and forcing them to do search and rescue is the only way this ship is getting out of this system alive.
Kyle stared at the hologram, and for a moment he would forever regret. Almost gave the order.
No, he finally said with a deep breath. We are not the Commonwealth. We will not embrace the slaughter of civilians in a moment of expediency or fanaticism.
No one would ever know, Glass objected. This is a black op for a reason.
They would find out,
Kyle said flatly. Hypocritical of them or not, they would hunt those who killed their people until the end of time.
No deception would last. No lie would hold them off. I will not answer atrocity with atrocity.
I order you,
Glass shouted, every scrap of relationship and rapport they'd built over the last months shattering in the face of what he clearly saw as failure.
Sergeant at arms,
Kyle bellowed, attracting the attention of the two Marines guarding the bridge door.
Remove Mr. Glass to his quarters. He is not permitted to leave until I authorize it. Damn it, Roberts. You'll doom us all.
No, Captain Kyle Roberts said calmly. I am the stellar fucking Fox. I will find another way. The argument had cost precious seconds, but thankfully, Rokos had already begun his abort. It couldn't help but draw attention to him, but the elevated alert level would rapidly involve calling in all fighter squadrons, and if they hadn't realized yet that they had 30 starfighters who weren't supposed to be there, they would shortly. Glass was right about one thing, Kyle knew. The Saint-class battleship was already heading their way. It wasn't fast. As a capital ship, it was designed for Tier 2 accelerations, less than half that of a starfighter. But it would catch Chameleon before she could flee. Unless that ship was distracted, the best they could hope for was to retrieve the starfighter plans and transmit them by QCOM before they died. Destroying the station outright might not even achieve that, he admitted grimly to himself. In the place of the Saint's captain, he'd risk missing some civilians by dropping his small craft for search and rescue while he took the battleship after the person who'd killed them. He needed a job they'd have to use the battleship for. Something where mere starfighters and search and rescue spacecraft just wouldn't cut it. The sheer scale of Shipyard Alpha tugged at his eye, and a cold smile spread across his face.
Get me a live link to Rokos, he ordered.
We have a problem,
Taylor announced grimly as Kyle cut the channel to the wing commander.
The research station just launched starfighters, and they're like nothing I've ever seen.
Show me, he ordered.
The holographic display zoomed in, providing a surprising quality of detail. One of the Q-probes had to be close to the station, keeping an eye on their assault shuttles. 10 strange-looking spacecraft had left one of the station's bays. Their vector wasn't a pursuit of Chameleon, but they were definitely angling in the direction of Kyle's ship, and he did not like the look of the ships. They consisted of a central spike, reminiscent of the very first starfighters the Federation had deployed, with scaffolding-like structures extending out on all four sides, and each of those scaffolding-like structures carried a missile half the size of the central hull.